I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Beth Kisseleff, co-editor of the new book, Bound in the Bond of Life, Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life Tragedy, published for the second anniversary of that terror massacre. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, and Moedim L'Simcha for the last time this season. The long Jewish fall holiday marathon ends with a wonderful bang on Simchat Torah, which was or is held today or yesterday, depending on your affiliation. I'll explain. If you're conservative or Orthodox and not living in the land of Israel, today is the wonderful festival of Simchat Torah, when we complete the reading of Torah and begin again for the coming year. Simchat Torah literally means rejoicing with the Torah, or celebrating the teaching, perhaps, and it's a time of singing, dancing, and real joy. We celebrated Friday night at Congregation Beit Simcha, my synagogue. You can join the fun after the fact through the video on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson on Facebook, and it was as much fun as anybody can manage to have in the midst of a pandemic. Simchat Torah always reminds me of when I started as a student at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. They asked me to lead services, but I was starting after Simchat Torah, so I just went to services. I sat through the first few hakafot, the parades with the Torah, listening to dull, plodding songs. Finally, I turned to the dean of the college, Rabbi Ken Ehrlich, and asked him, "What's going on?" Like me, he is descended from Eastern European Jews who do Simchas Torah singing and dancing with great enthusiasm and energy, a near wanton celebration, to be honest. Ken explained that when he first came to the college, the Torah Hakafot for Simchat Torah were done in a slow, stately procession, accompanied by plodding organ music. He himself turned to a professor and said, "It's Simchas Torah. How come they're marching, not dancing?" And the professor answered, "They are German Jews. They are dancing." Anyway, here's what Simchat Torah is supposed to sound like. On Simchat Torah, which literally means celebration of Torah, we actually complete reading the end of the book of Deuteronomy with the story of the death of Moses, and then immediately open a second Torah and chant the opening passages of Genesis. As Jews, we're always reading Torah, and Simchat Torah celebrates our dedication to learning and growing in knowledge, and we hope, in our relationship to God. And as a way to end the holiday cycle for the fall, which began way back at the start of September with Slichot, continuing through Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, Simchat Torah is a great way to complete it all with Torah. Speaking of Torah, one of the highest principles in Torah is tzedakah, especially charitable work that helps keep people working. In an effort to revive a struggling Israeli music industry, which is heavily dependent on live public performances prevented by the pandemic, a group called Call to Action, a project that in Hebrew is Tzav HaShaah, is paying Israeli artists a modest sum, about $1,400 each, to record covers of classic Israeli songs. This music project is the brainchild of Inbar Nacht, chairwoman of the Inbar and Marius Nacht Foundation, which committed about $1 million to help the struggling Israeli music industry. Among the artists participating are Aviv Geffen, Amir Dadon, Rita, Karen Pellis, Netta Barzilai, and Sarit Haddad. One of the songs they've recorded in this project is Breishit, a setting of Ehud Manor's beautiful poem Breishit, called Genesis. The text is, "In the beginning there was sky, in the beginning the sea was blue, in the beginning I had day and night, hours as many as sand. In the beginning the land was a soft grass as a present for her, in the beginning. A garden in Eden, garden with no gate, from heaven good rain falling, God merciful with dawn. He gave you to me to guard and keep, you to me. In the beginning I had sun, in the beginning birds sang to me, in the beginning the fruit was ripe, come evening, strawberries, grains. I had night, the winds chanted a lullaby for me and you, a garden in Eden." The new recording they made of that song featured Israeli stars Dikla and Zahava Ben. It sounds like this.
בראשית היה ים כחול, בראשית היו לי יום ולילה, לילה שעות הרבה כחול. בראשית הייתה הארץ דשא עשב רך כשיילה,
unfortunately, I think one of the original artists who recorded this song did a much better job. This week of Simchat Torah and the chanting of Breishit in Shabbat services, Genesis, here's Gabi Shoshan's 2011 cover of his own recording from way back in the 1970s, Breishit.
היה הים כחול, בראשית היו לי יום ולילה, לילה שעות הרבה כחול. בראשית הייתה הארץ ושעשב רך כשיילה, ואלוהים היה לחום עם שחר, ולמשמר
That was the song Bereshit, Genesis, for the beginning of the Torah this week. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Beth Kiseleff, co-editor of the new book, Bound in the Bond of Life, Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life Tragedy, published for the second anniversary of that terror massacre, we'll explain how the book came to be. Find out when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. You can join us for limited in-person attendance on Shabbat, masked and socially distanced, if you call 520-276-5675 in advance and request attendance. And of course, everybody can come on Facebook Live. Beit Simcha Synagogue's located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. In our own building, not in the mall, services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus Tzoras, join us Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening service celebrations at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha, Tucson. And we'll hold our services with full music by virtual experience there every week for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access that by emailing me at rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Synagogues on 2270 West Ina, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. You can email me with other questions at rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, all taught through Zoom, and of course all of our services on Facebook Live, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 5-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregational community in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Beth Kiseleff is the co-author of the book Bound in the Bond of Life, just out for the second anniversary of the horrible Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life Tragedy. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning.
So tell us about the genesis of Bound in the Bond of Life.
My brother's a documentary filmmaker, and he came here shortly after the shooting and was thinking of doing a movie about the things that were happening here. And I said, well, if you want to see the artifacts that were left at the site of the building, you need to get in touch with Eric Ligi, who works at the Heinz History Center, because he's going to be the custodian of all the artifacts. He's going to add them to the 150-year-old history of Jews in Pittsburgh, all the things that have already been put in his archive at the History Center. And, you know, he can give you access to some of the artifacts and the stories behind them, because that was what my brother was interested in was the response from the community, the outpouring that came after the shooting. So my brother didn't end up doing that documentary, but that was the first time I met Eric, you know, around the community, but I'd, you know, kind of made contact with him. And then I just looked back at my emails, actually, to ascertain what the genesis of this was. So our synagogue, New Light Synagogue, where my husband, Rabbi Jonathan Perlman, is the rabbi, decided that as part of our healing process, we'd take a trip to Charleston, South Carolina, to the Mother Emanuel Church on Martin Luther King Day 2019. And we went with both congregants from New Light, the family members of one of the victims, and members of the study group at the Robin Street Missionary Baptist Church, where my husband had been doing a joint study, and one of the victims, Rich Gottfried, had been part of the study group. And so people that knew him from the study group, members of the church, came on the trip with us. So there were 10 of us on the trip, and after we got back from the trip, we had a meeting at my house, and I, since I'm a writer myself, I encouraged everybody to write about the trip, and I thought I'd make up a little booklet of things people had to say about the trip and send it to the different groups that hosted us. We went to the Reform congregation in Charleston Friday night. We went to the Orthodox congregation Saturday morning, because those are the two congregations that are still in the historic downtown. We went to the Mother Emanuel Church on Sunday, so I wanted to just, I thought that would be an appropriate way to thank those groups. So I didn't end up doing that anthology, but it came to me after that that maybe it would be interesting to have some other local writers speak about what had happened. And I contacted Eric and said, you know, I have this idea, maybe we could put together an anthology and I'll edit the essays and you can select some objects and we can have sort of the essays and photos. So Eric said, okay, let's meet. So we met and we talked about it, and something very different emerged. Eric's idea was that this should be primarily local writers speaking about what happens locally, because there'd been a lot of media coverage from people around the country. And we really felt that he, particularly as part of his job as the curator of a local Jewish history archive, he particularly thought it was important to have people writing about the experience from the aspect of local history. So my initial idea isn't what we ended up with, but I'm glad that he helped shape the book in that way.
It's quite a book, and we'll talk much more about Bound in the Bond of Life, Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life Tragedy, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with 100,000 downloads to our credit. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking a couple weeks ago about Montenegro, a very complicated place, like everywhere in the Balkans, but maybe more so. And you mentioned that when you worked there for the World Union of Jewish Students way back in the 1970s, they told you, there's no Jews, don't bother, don't even look there. And so you didn't.
Right.
Except that's not exactly right.
Right. That was the universally held opinion by people in what was then a federal Yugoslavia that consisted of all these different republics that I mentioned, plus the two autonomous regions. In the 90s, there was armed conflict, and the former Yugoslavia broke up. It was untenable in the long run and took a really strong man and a canny, wily politician like Tito to hold it together. Once he died...
And a fair amount of brutality, we might add.
Not so much.
Okay.
Certainly not compared to any of his neighbors.
Okay.
He used more carrots than sticks. Anyway, when Yugoslavia itself dissolved as a result of armed conflict, multiple armed conflicts in the 1990s, Montenegro was left technically independent. But for historic and cultural reasons, chose to federate with Serbia. So what was left of the former Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, blah, 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 was only Serbia and Montenegro. And that union was divided by a peaceful referendum sometime early in the 20th century. I don't remember the year exactly. I'm sorry, maybe 2006, 2008.
The 21st century.
Yeah, right. Okay. 2010, sometime around
some
then.
Some kind of an agreement.
It lasted, you know, for 8 years. It was a happy divorce, just like the Czech Republic and Slovakia. No hostility between the two countries at all. Lots of Montenegrins live in Belgrade. Lots of Serbs live in Podgorica, which is the new name for the capital of Montenegro that used to be called Titograd. So, fast forward. There was a man who is now deceased named Jaša Alfandari, who was born in Montenegro, volunteered to fight in the Israeli army during the Six-Day War in 1967, then spent most of his adult life working for Israel's intelligence services, where he learned a lot of skills, and then returned to Montenegro in roughly 2010. Then what he did was he devoted his life to hunting out, ferreting out Jews who didn't know they were Jewish from old family records, and he used all the tricks of the trade that he learned in Israeli intelligence work, and eventually persuaded the president of Montenegro to make Judaism the fourth official religion of the country, along with Islam, Orthodox Christianity, and Roman Catholicism. And he persuaded a couple hundred of the Jews he could find to form a national federation of the Jewish community of Montenegro. So that was created in 2012. Just now, the president of that resigned for health reasons, very elderly, was replaced by a much younger woman through a free and fair election. And the animus, the soul for the current community, really comes from a marvelous Chabad rabbi who was born and raised in L.A., but
as all good rabbis are, we
spent years in Israel, has a wonderful wife and a lot of kids who help him tirelessly in his work. And he tells me interesting stories about the size and the nature of the Jewish community in Montenegro. And I would like to share some of those with you next week.
That sounds good. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk then. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A middle-aged couple visits Israel with the wife's elderly mother along on the trip. Sadly, the wife's mother dies while they are in Israel. The couple meets with an Israeli funeral director who informs them, "You have two options. You can bury her here in Israel for just $1,000. Or we can make all the arrangements to ship her body back to America. That'll cost you about $10,000, plus paying for the funeral plot and the burial there. Which option are you going to use?" The husband answers pretty quickly, "We'll pay the $10,000 to send her home." As they leave the funeral home, the wife says, I'm really proud of you, honey. I didn't think you even liked my mother, and you agreed to pay so much money to send her home. I mean, for your mother-in-law, I'm really proud." Well, her husband answers, "I've heard that when people get buried in Israel, sometimes they come back to life." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This coming Shabbat, we'll read the spectacular Torah portion of Bereshit, Genesis, beginning of all things. It starts with those still amazing words, Bereshit bara Elohim, at the beginning of God's creating, or in the beginning God created. Simple, lucid, concise. All creation emanating from one point and place, a divine force or intelligence or energy, starting the great process of existence and eventually of all life. A singularity, a poem to the holy unity of all being, everything from the same source. And yet, the text of Genesis is deliberately ambiguous in order to encourage exploration and debate. The essential tools we human beings have for learning truth and discerning meaning. Questions abound. Why is God necessary at all for creation? The great Jewish poet Paul Celan wrote, "No one needs us out of earth and clay. No one summons our dust. Blessed art thou, no one." I'd argue with Celan that such wonder as creation did not come into being purely by accident. But there's room for argument, which is good, and perhaps God-given, and certainly very Jewish. The notion that God created and then saw each thing good provoked from the great British author D.H. Lawrence the poetic speculation that the true mystery of creation is the divine urge of creation, a great, strange urge. Even an artist knows his work was never in his mind. He could never have thought it before it happened. God is a great urge, wonderful, mysterious, magnificent, but knows nothing beforehand. God's urge takes shape in the flesh, and lo, it is creation. God looks on it himself in wonder for the first time. Lo, there is a creature formed. How strange. Let me think about it. Let me form an idea. We can argue, discuss, and explore whether such a marvel as the intricate workings of our world or our bodies, even a single cell, could exist without some coherent plan or design. What a rich area for intellectual and spiritual engagement. Genesis is where real understanding and learning begin. This is where we start to shape our faith and our theology, our beliefs. This book helps form our character. This is how Torah commences, with the invitation to begin exploring a great and sacred text in partnership with God, in community with the whole people of Israel. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Beth Kisseleff, co-editor of the new book Bound in the Bond of Life, Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life Tragedy, just published for the second anniversary of that terror massacre, explains what moved her most in creating this powerful book. Find out when we return on Two Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Before we get to the typical year 2020 bad news, there is some good news, which we'll explore more completely next week when we talk about Jewish Nobel Prize winners generally. This year, the Nobel Prizes for Medicine, Physics, and most dramatically Literature, given to Jewish poet Louise Glück, were won by Jews. This is not exactly a shock, but it's nice to see a tradition continue in which Jews, representing far less than 1% of the world's population, have nonetheless won over 23% of all Nobel Prizes? Wow. And now on to the bad news. Protests by ultra-Orthodox Haredi Jews against New York's crackdown on gatherings in their neighborhoods turned tense and sometimes violent last week. Throngs of young men demonstrated in the streets of Borough Park. The late-night protests in the heavily ultra-Orthodox area of Brooklyn took aim at new restrictions, closing schools, limiting attendance at synagogue services, and closing non-essential businesses in areas with quick upticks in COVID-19. The protesters actually set fire to a pile of masks. At one point, they surrounded a city bus moving through the area, and at another, ran a reporter out of the area. In a violent episode, one man, the brother of Morty Goetz, a well-known Orthodox businessman who who was outspoken about the need for masks and social distancing earlier in the pandemic. This man was beaten so severely by protesters when he took a video of the scene that he was taken to the hospital. Onlookers could be heard calling him a moser, one who informs on fellow Jews to authorities, and who some Jewish legal authorities say can be killed. The protests made evident the frustration felt by local ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are now at the center of the first widespread resurgence of COVID in New York since the very terrible spring they had there. Many in the community believe city and state officials are unfairly targeting ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are already vulnerable to anti-Semitism in this pandemic response. Local elected officials and community leaders vowed to resist the rules through litigation and civil disobedience. "We will not close," radio host and local celebrity Heshy Tischler proclaimed to cheers from the crowds. Later, he told protesters, "You're my soldiers. We're at war." Dov Hicken, the former state assemblyman, who is a leader in the community, said the protest took a form that was very regrettable. "I'm ashamed of what happened," Hicken said. "To raise your hand and touch another person, Jew or non-Jew, to injure someone and have them end up in the hospital is a tragedy. If there would have been a protest last night organized by community leaders and elected officials where everyone was wearing a mask, then of course no problem. There's nothing wrong with expressing yourself. That's not what happened." Kamen Yeager, who represents Borough Park on the New York City Council, denounced the violence at the protest. "I'm disgusted by the attack in the early morning hours on a member of our community," he wrote. "There is never a reason to raise a hand to a fellow human. We are better than that. I hope the attackers realize how wrong this was. NYPD will investigate violent crimes in our community." These protests came in response to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's announcement of new restrictions on a large swath of Brooklyn that is experiencing an uptick in COVID cases. His announcement followed a similar one by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who during the Jewish holiday of Sukkot last week said he would move to close schools, pending the governor's approval. The governor then approved. Most Orthodox schools, of course, were already closed for Sukkot. Agudat Israel, an organization representing Haredi ultra-Orthodox communities, expressed frustration with the lack of notice given about the restrictions, suggested the new rules might be unconstitutional, and filed a lawsuit. Governor Cuomo's surprise mass closure announcement and limit of 10 individuals per house of worship in red zones is appalling to all people of religion and good faith, they said. Recently, a federal judge issued an injunction blocking New York State from imposing stricter standards on indoor gatherings at religious services than those imposed on other gathering places, citing religious liberty concerns. Agudat Israel has now filed a lawsuit to try to extend that rule. The protesters in Borough Park were joined one night by Tischler and Yeager, who encouraged the crowd to stand up for religious freedom. "We are not going to be deprived of the right we have in America, like everybody else in America, the right to observe our religion." Tischler said, "I don't care who in government thinks they can stop us. They're wrong. Let them try." Well, apparently it's also a right to get COVID-19. Videos circulated of protesters also chanting "Jewish Lives Matter." At one point, protesters really did set fire to a pile of masks in the middle of the street, and one photographer trying to capture the chaotic scene in Borough Park was videoed being chased and assaulted by a crowd of Hasidic Jews. The positive test rate on, that is, COVID-19 tests in Borough Park was 10.6% last week, more than 10 times the overall rate in the state. Rising infection rates in those neighborhoods, officials fear, could trigger a second wave of virus in New York City, which had, until these upticks, kept rates low after experiencing a severe outbreak in the spring. And in Israel, an ultra-Orthodox Haredi funeral that had gotten special permission to include hundreds of people instead drew thousands to Ashdod, the Israeli city in the south, resulting in clashes between mourners and police who attempted to disperse them. The funeral was for Rabbi Mordechai Leifer, 65 years old, known as the Rebbe of Pittsburgh, who died of coronavirus amid Israel's current spike in cases. His Hasidic sect was founded in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, about 100 years ago. He has led his followers, several dozen families in Ashdod, for decades. Israel's under lockdown, but Leifer's funeral had been permitted to go on as long as those in attendance were capped at about 400 and they all wore masks and practiced appropriate social distancing. But Unfortunately, about 5,000 people showed up, which made distancing impossible. Clashes broke out between mourners and police as Israeli police attempted to disperse those gathered for the funeral. The clashes came a day after reported violence between police and Haredi ultra-Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem neighborhoods and in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox Tel Aviv suburb of Bnei Brak over enforcement of the lockdown rules. Police found synagogues and yeshivas full of people in the neighborhoods and people not wearing masks, handed out fines leading to the unrest. At least 20 people were arrested in the clashes. Israel is under lockdown conditions still as a second wave of COVID-19 infections spirals upward. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Beth Kisloff is an author and the editor of the new book, Bound in the Bond of Life, Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life Tragedy, being published in time for the second anniversary of that awful event, one of the worst anti-Semitic attack on a synagogue in American history, the first fatal one. The second one, of course, occurred about 6 months later in Poway, California. The facts of the story are not in dispute. The reflections of the writers vary tremendously. How did you guys choose who wrote, and what were the biggest surprises in that process?
So our primary criteria was we wanted people who were professional writers in some capacity, so people that knew how to process their ideas and put them into words. So we have some people that are professional writers who teach writing at universities. We have people that are journalists. We have rabbis. We have academics. We have a poet. So it was really important to us that we pick people that knew how to articulate their ideas in language, because it's a very difficult situation, very difficult thing to wrap your head around. And we knew that if we chose people that were writers, that they'd be able to do to write meaningful essays. What were the surprises? Well, one thing I really loved, we have three non-Jewish writers, and I really loved reading non-Jews reflecting Jewish teachings back. There's one who's a religion journalist at the local Pittsburgh newspaper, and one of the things he talks about is going to a Jewish camp in Poland right before Tisha B'Av, and what he learned there from the rabbi, that that the temple is built on love and on kind, you know, deeds of kindness. And it was so meaningful to me to see that non-Jews being around Jews can absorb something meaningful. That's Peter Smith's essay. Another writer, Campbell Robertson, who's the national reporter for the New York Times and is based in Pittsburgh, wrote about going to the Shiva for Jerry Rabinowitz, who was a doctor who was a member of Dor Chadash, the Reconstructionist congregation. And at that Shiva, someone said that when Adam and Eve were created, and the first day it was dark, it was evening, right, and they thought that that dark would be permanent, but then in the morning the dawn came. And Robertson writes about that, you know, the dawn always comes. And I thought that I believe it's from Avodah Zarah in the Talmud, and it was just beautiful to me to see how someone from outside our tradition comes in and captures something of our tradition, that optimism that's really an important part of the Jewish philosophy and message.
There's a quite eloquent, not simple piece by Rabbi Jonathan Perlman, in which he creates an Ela Eskara for Pittsburgh, reflecting on medieval precedents. Very interesting piece in the book.
Thank you. As a rabbi, I know you appreciate that.
Yeah, it's kind of my business. It's true.
Yeah, he worked very, very hard on that.
Clearly. You then have to print in Hebrew, too, don't you?
Right.
That's a publishing problem. That's a kind of a challenge, you know, just in a literal to produce the book.
last High Holidays, unfortunately, the three congregants that were killed were the people that were most ritually active in the synagogue, and we had to hire someone as the chazanit for Shacharit because Rich Gottfried blew the shofar and davened Shacharit. So we hired a woman named Yael Kalman,
and he was one of the victims. He was one of the
Rich Gottfried was one of the victims, one of the three victims. So the chazanit we hired came and davened beautifully, but it turns out that her husband, David C. Kalman, is a typesetter. So I, after my husband wrote this, I sent it to him, and he works for the Hartman Institute, so I thought maybe he would help publicize it through them. But he looked at it and said, "Can I typeset this?" And I said, "Absolutely."
Sure.
Thank you. So it was real. I mean, I can't tell you how many things have happened this year. They're just wonderful coincidences like that. So, you know, we hired someone to help us with the holidays last year, and we also got a fantastic typesetter. So I just gave the typeset file to the University of Pittsburgh Press, and they were able to work with it. Although it was very funny because the designer at the press is Jewish, and he knows Hebrew, but just rudimentary Hebrew. And my co-editor and I had to sit with him on the phone because it was very important to us to get the Hebrew names of all the 11 martyrs right. And then we also printed a prayer that another rabbi in the community, Rabbi Daniel Yalkut, whose sermons are also in the book, wrote. And so we had to, you know, kind of look at the computer screen and say, okay, the fifth word from the left, you know, the third letter in, no, fix that. It was a very painstaking process.
Oh, my goodness.
We, fortunately, it turned out the designer was Jewish. He knew enough Hebrew to make sure that all the Hebrew was right. But in my husband's Ezra, it was all properly typeset.
So
that's a great question. I mean, if you want to ask me more about the theology behind that or anything else, I'm happy to.
No, that's great. That. Thank you. I was in reflecting on the book. It is really a kind of a community speaking here. You get
Absolutely.
That feeling, including, as you mentioned, some non-Jewish outsiders, some professional journalists who had barely been in Pittsburgh for very long, but lived there for a year or so. How did you decide what order to put them in?
So that was a difficult process. My co-editor and I each had different ideas. He wanted sort of an associative link, you know, from one essay to the other.
Sure.
Both of us agreed
kind of like Talmud, right? You know,
an associative exactly. No, and coincidentally, we're both doing Daf Yomi now. We started in January.
Mazel tov. Good.
Sorry?
Good. Mazel tov.
Yeah,
that's great.
Thank
stuff
you. Thank you. It's really something I've been really enjoying doing. So he thought that it made sense to have kind of associative links. We both agreed immediately that the first essay, Molly Pascal's Here is Squirrel Hill, which is a play off E.B. White's Here is New York,
yeah.
should definitely be the lead-off essay. Gets a lovely picture of Squirrel Hill and what it's like.
What it's like to grow up there
Pittsburgh
and all the rest
resident.
Of it. Right, exactly.
Then I'm not even sure when I came up with this idea that it should be three sections. So one, Here's Squirrel Hill, is essays that are around the topic of just kind of describing the neighborhood, describing what it's like, positioning you in Squirrel Hill. The second section is taken from an interview with Rabbi Daniel Yalkut. I went to speak to him when we were trying to figure out what his contribution would be. And in the course of the interview, he said, you know, what I was trying to do for my congregation was to help them find the kalim, the vessels that would help them cope. And he suggests a number of things in his sermons. But I thought that this notion of finding the vessels was very powerful. So in that section, I grouped things like my husband's Ela Ezkara, the liturgical poem that we read on Yom Kippur that describes Jewish martyrs throughout the ages and tries to position our own martyrs within that history. So essays that were about how to cope with this situation. And the final section is called You Will Get Through This, and Linda Hurwitz, whose parents are Holocaust survivors, had a daughter who was murdered in their backyard by a schizophrenic classmate when she was a senior in high school.
Oh,
and she
God.
Had to call her parents and tell them about this. And she said the first thing they said to her was, "You'll get through this." And that sense of resilience
wow.
and strength is really what I wanted to end the book with. So her essay, it's a very powerful one, is the last in the book, and also Campbell Robertson's essay that I mentioned before with it, that ends with this optimism, the sense of dawn, you know, that even though it's dark, the dawn will always come. So I grouped essays that have that sense of how to get through it. So and you know, one thing I'd like to say to any potential readers is that the topic is grim, but the essays are not all grim. There's one, Brooke Barker's, that's funny, lighthearted. There are a lot of ways to grapple with this, and it's important to realize that it's possible to make meaning out of tragedy, and that's what Linda Hurwitz does in her essay, and what the last section does. So it's not, you can
you know,
agree or disagree. It's not a difficult book to read. I mean, it's
no, I don't think it is at all.
It's not.
Obviously, the subject is tremendously powerful, but that's what Jews have been doing for a very long time, making meaning
exactly.
out of tragedy.
Exactly.
I want to ask two more questions. We have time
sure.
for one, so let's keep them quick. Which is the most, and it's a difficult question, maybe an unfair one, what's the most powerful piece in the book for you?
Well, that's very difficult.
It's
I mean,
like,
I
which of
I
your children
say,
do you like
yeah,
the best?
No, yeah. I just have to say my husband's because...
That's fair.
I want to stay married. No, but I think he's the, I mean, he's the only person in the book who was in the building, so who
right.
personally was there and had to grapple with this on a very visceral level. You know, I went to shul later. The shooter came right at the very beginning
of
the service.
Yeah, he didn't really understand how Jews attend Saturday morning, or he would have killed more people, probably.
I mean, it's a terrible joke to make, but we were saying, when someone said that, we're saying, shh, you know, don't say that.
Don't let people know that, yeah. Don't tempt the Satan.
Yes. But no, it's and there was a bat mitzvah the week before. There were 250 people in the building, so we're fortunate that the carnage wasn't.
Was it even worse?
Yeah.
How has
and we don't know why he chose that synagogue. Maybe there was no security. You know, I don't know whether he canvassed other synagogues, but every synagogue in Pittsburgh has a security now. But no, just to get back to why I find my husband's the most powerful, because.
Sure.
You know, he really used the resources of the Jewish tradition, the Torah portion that was supposed to be read that day that was never read, Genesis 22, the story of Abraham binding Isaac, and the mystery of
right,
it, and
Akedah,
then the mystery of why Jews were slaughtered is something we don't understand, but he used the resources of the tradition to grapple with this horrific event, and it's a very powerful piece of writing, and I'm very proud of him. It was very difficult for him.
I'm sure.
So.
And I'm sure difficult for him to process the whole experience. It's not something
yes.
that anybody
yes.
gets
and
over.
And also, which you'll understand as a rabbi yourself, it's we're not just processing it for ourselves and our family,
community.
But we're trying to help our congregants that lost family members. Process it. We're trying to be there for them, and we're also trying to create a way for the entire congregation to think about how to process and understand it. So,
and really, that's what the book is about. Maybe
right.
not just the whole congregation, but the whole Jewish community of America, and maybe everyone to understand how one of these intense tragedies has a tremendous impact on a community, and how people do find ways of giving it meaning and moving on.
Exactly. So that was important to us, that it not just be about the impact of the tragedy, but how to find it meaningful, and how to continue to move forward in a healthy way. so I hope it'll remind people that mental health is important. Whatever emotions anybody feels around this or other tragedies, it's important to be aware of them and to try to understand them. Personally, I hope this book moves the needle on gun reform in this country that I believe is sorely needed. But, you know, it's absolutely written for the general Jewish community, but also for anybody that's concerned about the impact of hate in this country. There's been a tremendous growth in the rise of hate groups and white supremacy, and I'd hope that readers understand just how damaging they are.
I want to thank Beth Kisla for a great visit here on Two Jewish. The book is called Bound in the Bond of Life, Pittsburgh Writers Reflect on the Tree of Life tragedy. Where can people go to find out more about the book?
You can go to the website of the University of Pittsburgh Press, who is the publisher. You can go to your favorite independent bookstore. You can go to our Pittsburgh independent bookstore, Classic Lines.
All good places. Thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you.
And Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, Moedim L'Simcha.
Chagim Uzmanim L'Sason. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from the Klezmer Celebration of Simchat Torah. It's from the Maxwell Street Klezmer Band called Glitzianer versus Litvak. A lot of fun. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Karen Reb Rudel, who runs virtual tours of the Jewish sites of Paris during this pandemic. Don't miss her. She's really great. My friends, may you have a wonderful end of the holiday season, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.